Now for our latest radio hour and a half, we have people who are going to introduce themselves to the program. Marilyn is a fellow worker, and she is one of the delegates, and very passionate peacenik, and she's going to tell you more.
Well, I don't know how much more I need to tell you. My name is Marilyn. I use the pronouns she, they. And if you want to join the IWW, if you're interested, you can contact us via our Facebook site, and I would be glad to give you more information.
My name is fellow worker Noah. I use he, him pronouns. I'm also a delegate of the Tacoma branch of the IWW. You're welcome to reach out to me or Marilyn, like she said, over on our Facebook page, or through the WAB Radio Hour Facebook page as well. If you shoot us a message and you want to organize your workplace, whether it's here locally or in whatever workplace that you're working, we're happy to help you out with that. I've been a member since March of 2021, and I've really enjoyed being a part of the union and being a part of the radio. Go ahead, fellow worker Gordon.
Hi, I'm fellow worker Gordon. I use he, him pronouns. I live in Bremerton, but I'm a member of the Tacoma General Membership Branch of the Industrial Workers of the World. I'm a retired shipyard worker, having retired from the metal trades in Bremerton in 2008. Whereupon, a week later, I joined the IWW. So I've been a member since then and have served in various capacities, a couple of stints as a delegate, and also with Industrial Workers of the World media, like Seattle Worker and this radio show. That's it for me.
And I'm Lynn Swanson, and I'm a delegate, and I'm also, well, I think I'm the treasurer of this branch, the Tacoma branch of the IWW. And in case you were wondering how to spell WOB, it's W-O-B. And that's about all. I'm a retired social worker where I was a union member, and I'm a retired paraeducator where I was a union member. Come from a longshoring family. So that's it for me, and I go by she, her.
All righty. So now, let's warm up, shall we? We're in a new year. Happy New Year. We're in January, and this happens to be just before Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. So we picked We Shall Not Be Moved. I bet you know the tune to this. So I'll sing the first part. You guys join in.
Sounds good.
We shall not, we shall not be moved. We shall not, we shall not be moved. Just like a tree that's standing by the water. We shall not be moved. All right, sing it. We're on the road to freedom. We shall not be moved. On the road to freedom, we shall not be moved. Just like a tree that's standing by the water, we shall not be moved. We're standing all together, we shall not be moved. Standing all together, we shall not be moved. Just like a tree that's standing by the water, we shall not be moved. We shall not, we shall not be moved. We shall not, we shall not be moved. Just like a tree that's standing by the water, we shall not be moved.
Union!
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 Solidarity!
Solidarity.
Alrighty. And now to read us off a small section of the preamble of the Constitution of the IWW, fellow worker Marilyn, take it away again.
I picked out three paragraphs that I want to share. The working class and the employing class have nothing in common. There can be no peace so long as hunger and want are found among the millions of the working people, and the few who make up the employing class have all the good things of life. These conditions can be changed, and the interest of the working class upheld only by an organization. I picked out three paragraphs today. The working class and the employing class can have nothing in common.
There can be no peace so long as hunger and want are found among millions of the working people, and the few who make up the employing class have all the good things of life. These conditions can be changed in the interest of the working class upheld only by an organization formed in such a way that all of its members in any one industry, or in all industries if necessary, cease work whenever a strike or lockout is on in any department thereof, thus making an injury to one an injury to all. It is the historic mission of the working class to do away with capitalism. The army of production must be organized not only for everyday struggle with capitalists, but also to carry on production when capitalism shall have been overthrown. By organizing industrially, we are forming the structure of the new society within the shell of the old.
Well said, fellow worker Marilyn. Thank you again for joining the WOB Radio Show. We are going to be changing our title here soon, just down to WOB Radio, considering that our radio station, KTAH 101.9 Radio Tacoma, as well as KTQA 95.3, have allowed us an extra half an hour of time to bring you all the labor-related news, topics, education, and all the other local goings-on, as well as national labor struggles. So thank you so much for joining us again, and we hope you enjoy what we have to bring you. Starting off our show today, we like to start off with labor-related news currently taking place both locally as well as around the country. One of the biggest Supreme Court cases in regards to the right to strike is currently being heard by the Supreme Court is Teamsters versus Glacier Northwest. This is actually a case that originates from a labor strike here in Seattle, South Seattle specifically, between the workers organized with the Teamsters and the company Glacier Northwest. The results of this case could potentially endanger the right to strike. It would essentially force unions to pay for quote-unquote damages to the company's profits as a result of workers going on their legal right to strike should they choose to do so. So this would significantly hamper not just the financial ability of unions to organize and support striking workers, but would also disincentivize workers from being able to go on strike should this case be ruled in the favor of the employer and not the workers under the union. And I actually have an article here, and this is coming from In These Times. The Supreme Court heard oral arguments January 10th in Glacier Northwest Incorporated versus International Brotherhood of Teamsters, Local Union Number 174, a court case that labor advocates say threatens the right to strike. Quote, "The ability to withhold your labor is one of the most powerful tools throughout the history of unionization that has ensured workers can improve their working conditions," Teamsters General President Sean M. O'Brien offered in a statement issued the same day. Quote, "This right is now on trial at the Supreme Court," O'Brien said, calling on the court to affirm the rulings of lower courts. Noel J. Francisco, the Jones Day attorney representing Glacier Northwest, did not respond to a request for comment. So basically, the court is still currently having hearings over this case, but like I said earlier, it would essentially threaten workers to take their legal right to strike. And I think that the Supreme Court case is really, really fundamental to the rights of working people because, again, if this goes through, your only weapon against your employer for better wages, hours, and conditions, which is the threat of withholding said labor, could be completely taken out from under you, and there is no previous Supreme Court case that will be able to back you up if this case goes through in favor of the employer. So I think that this is a case that we really need to follow closely. I think it potentially sets a dangerous precedent for the future of organized labor.
No, duh.
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead, fellow worker.
Could you tell us the nature of the business of the company Glacier Northwest and how this struggle got started?
Basically, the whole background is that last year there was a strike between the Teamsters Local Number 174 in Seattle, striking on their employer, Glacier Northwest. They were involved in a bridge and road construction program. And essentially, these were concrete workers with the Teamsters Union. And during contract negotiations essentially fell through, and the workers went on strike. And then, I believe, and this is from the information I've been able to glean, the company essentially tried to sue the union because they were on strike for months. So they did lose a significant... They did face a significant loss of not just production.
One of the purposes of a strike?
Absolutely. The point of striking is to withhold your labor to force negotiations to continue to take place. And it is a protected legal federal right in this country. But essentially, the company Glacier Northwest tried to more or less send the union a bill for their loss of profits and their mm-hmm. loss of production, which went to lower courts and was ultimately appealed all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court is pretty conservatively backed right now in terms of the people who are sitting on the bench. And in previous court cases like this, or ones in lower courts adjacent to this, more conservatively minded judges tend to vote against the values of organized labor and more in favor of the employer for the sake of protecting the economy and protecting production. And also private property, which is
That's
also
the
other
one.
Big argument,
yep.
is that essentially this is quote-unquote damage being done to private property, a.k.a. a business, by the withholding of labor from the workers. So, yes, fellow worker Gordon?
Just to expand a little bit on that, I guess these concrete workers were specifically the concrete truck drivers, the big spinning barrels you see when you're going down the highway.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you've ever wondered why they have to keep spinning, it's because they got to keep the concrete liquid before it sets up. There's a few more technical aspects than just driving a big truck. Shifting load, it's hazardous. And these concrete truck drivers were essentially being cheated out of wages and cheated out of rights under their contract. So I think that might have got the whole thing started, but to that point, this particular Teamsters local was well aware that certain projects would make the working class suffer. Like they were building some low-income housing, and they didn't strike that location.
Mm-hmm.
They struck where the city and the state and the federal government were paying to get, the West Seattle Bridge. I think it was mm-hmm. part of the West mm-hmm. Seattle Bridge remodeling project. Necessary infrastructure. That thing is used daily. And so it was a conscious withholding of labor from profiteers. They did not withhold their services from worthy construction projects.
Exactly. Yeah, it'll be interesting to follow along with this case.
Mm-hmm.
I think that this previous year, there were more successful organizing campaigns and as well as a steep increase in public support of unions. And I think that what is happening at the Supreme Court level is part of a broader backlash against this new wave of labor mm-hmm. organizing.
Oh, sure.
And not only that, but also the democratization of some processes of unions as well has also been under question. But sticking to organizing campaigns and the growing support of unions, I think that this is going to be part of a larger backlash. And this has been seen historically, as I'll discuss later in the radio show, with things like the Wagner Act of 1935 or Taft-Hartley of 1947, which were federal laws passed by Congress, but they were reactions by business interests, by capital, against growing working class movements. In this case, labor unions in this country gaining more rights and more privileges for workers.
I wonder what we can do, Wobblies, as individuals, as citizens,
mm-hmm.
that might help influence the outcome of this court case.
I do not know, and not to sound critical or unsupportive, but in my opinion, I think that the only thing that can be done has to be done outside of the courts. It has to be done on the shop floor by organizing. It has to be taking similar cases like this to court, backing those movements, whether that's through supporting legal funds.
Oh, sure. We could do that.
Right. Whether that's informing people as to what's going on a national level, because a lot of people aren't really paying close attention to this. I mean, there are some obviously left-wing and labor-related journalists and newspapers and news sites covering this, but people don't really think a whole lot about labor rights and labor law. that often, at least not as often as we here, especially on the radio show, do. So I think that just informing people as to what's going on and how that will personally impact them and their coworkers is really important.
I think that is important.
Well, thank goodness the Supreme Court signaled their intentions earlier. Yes. when they overturned Roe v. Wade, and that woke up literally all the women in the country.
Absolutely.
And it was just like, whether they were pro or anti or somewhere in between, you just don't go around taking half the population's rights away, you know, at a whim. Mm-hmm. And so that at least made people alert as to the real intention of this Supreme Court in its current iteration. But we can also remind them, hey, you don't miss your labor rights until they take them away. Meaning your weekends, meaning your 8-hour a day, meaning everything else will come tumbling like a bunch of dominoes. That's what they intend to do, and they broadcast that, and they've made it very clear.
Right, like you hinted at, the right to strike is the fundamental foundation on the rest of those labor rights, and if the right to strike gets shut down, things like the 8-hour workday come under threat.
Yeah.
Things like your employer having to provide insurance as the unions demand.
All of it.
Fall away. Yeah.
All of it.
It's fundamental. It lays the groundwork for everything else. And if it wasn't for some of the biggest strikes in the early 20th century, we would not have that kind of organized labor power that we even do now. Yes, fellow worker Lynn?
You mentioned 1946 and 47 for Taft-Hartley, and then mm-hmm. What was the other one?
Wagner Act was 1935.
Okay. And are those the ones that gave rights to union workers, or did unions have become legalized way back earlier?
Maybe I could elucidate on that a little bit. The original Wagner Act, of course, came during the Great Depression and during FDR's second term, I think.
Mm-hmm.
First term, 32, he was elected. But that was a direct result of militant labor action going on all throughout the United States and the horrible reactions that was, that employers were taking. So in order to have what they now call labor peace, they enacted these protections pretty much at gunpoint for workers, because FDR was a pretty smart politician. And so we said, if we don't give these guys some rights, there's going to be a revolution.
And mm-hmm. You know what? I kind of object to giving people rights. These are our rights.
There we go.
They're inherent.
Yeah.
They're self-evident.
Nobody's giving us the right. It is our right.
You're right. You're completely correct about that.
And with the Wagner Act, that was basically the government recognizing some of those rights.
Unions have a right to exist, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
And then they watered it down in the reactionary government after World War II, when Truman was president still until 48, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that was the Labor Management Relations Act, also known as Taft-Hartley, for the senators who muscled it through.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1954, there was a further act. It was called the Labor Management Reporting and Disclosure Act. And this was a direct result of some labor unions being mobbed up. And so they wanted to get into the labor unions' books. It's a powerful tool to bring unions to heel if they're doing wrong, but also to set them up if they're not doing wrong.
Yep.
And to have lots of government oversight into your personal unions, how you pick officers, mm-hmm. What are your bylaws, all this kind of stuff. And the IWW has always been a revolutionary union. We have been forced to comply in order to be a legal labor union, forced to comply with the current labor law, but we don't always enthusiastically support every provision of those labor laws because they're repressive.
I think the other part of the conversation that's happening here, rights versus laws, I think that, and this is something dangerous to say as a union, but as an individual, and I'm speaking as an individual here, labor law has a lot of bogus stuff in it, as we'll cover later in the show. And as we've already touched on, these rights are fundamental to all workers. So when the law contradicts that, or if in this case the Supreme Court contradicts that, we should still have the guts and the spine
mm-hmm.
to enforce those laws collectively as a body of workers, or at least enforce those rights collectively as a body of workers.
Amen.
Regardless of what the law says.
Right.
Because it was only through labor organizing at a time when it was illegal that we got to have laws and protections for us in the present day. breaking the law at one point in our history, and possibly again in the future, is going to have to be a part of this story. Peaceful dissent, peaceful protest, going on strike has always forced people to the table to recognize our ability to see our rights as rights. So that is definitely a big part of the conversation.
That's an excellent parallel. We mentioned at the top of the broadcast that
exactly.
It was Martin Luther King's birthday coming up, and John Lewis had a saying about getting in good trouble.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's good trouble and bad trouble, right?
Yeah.
And advocating for justice can never be trouble in the historical long view. You know, if you're going to argue against an unjust law and take the consequences, and so many people got very grievously injured, both in body and in spirit, you know, but they managed to carry the day. And our laws restricting civil rights had to change, and they did. So direct action.
Yeah, and you want to go back a little further, and the women's right to vote, that had to be done with civil disobedience.
Sure.
Child labor laws, that had to be done with civil disobedience.
Yep.
Any of these things. Slavery itself, that was legal.
Right. I mean, it did take a civil war to ultimately end that. But I'm sure there's a conversation there about what the rule of violence might be, but I think that might be a little bit too spicy for the radio.
It used to be legal to stone your wife or your partner
mm-hmm.
for infidelity.
Well, right. I thought that meant just giving her a bong hit or something.
Be quiet.
But no, these are very fundamental conversations about the rights of workers taking place in the Supreme Court and in the public at large. And this is a conversation that has to include everybody. Everybody needs to be educated as to what's going on, which is why we provide this radio show in the first place. And people need to be aware of what threats are coming to their fundamental rights as working people. Because if we don't pay enough attention to this case, if we don't mount some kind of counteroffensive, if it rules in favor of the employer, those rights will and can be chipped away, which is why we as a body of workers need to enforce those rights in whatever manner is available to us, regardless of what the law, or in this case, the Supreme Court, says. And that's pretty much the gist of what I have to say about this. And of course, we're going to provide you more updates as this goes along. I don't know if this case will only last a matter of weeks. I don't know if it's going to last a matter of months. Supreme Court cases can take a while to go through, as we've seen with major cases that have provided people fundamental rights on a legal basis, such as the right to get an abortion or the right to
marry a person of a different race
or even somebody of the same sex. So we will try and keep you informed on this as much as possible, because you, the listener, needs to know about this, because this does concern you. In terms of other labor-related news and updates, we'd also like to touch again on the Railway Workers United settlement, which was essentially muscled through by Congress, by both parties in power. There's been quite a bit of political fallout as a result of that.
I have a few things that I want to say about that.
Go ahead.
I was reading the December issue of the Jacobin magazine,
mm-hmm.
December 15th, and there's a little justice here. So the title of the article is "Train Engineers Just Ousted Their Union President for Supporting the Rail Bill."
Yep.
So this is by Jonah Furman. "In the wake of the rail showdown, locomotive engineers have voted to boot their union president. It's a stunning upset, and one that shows that rank-and-file rail workers are still simmering at the contract that was forced on them." And those of you that have been following in this understand that one of the major issues in the whole proposed strike and the problem with the negotiations that they were being forced to take is that they still didn't get adequate sick leave.
Nope.
I think they have maybe 1 or 2 days
a year. Day.
One day.
Yeah.
That's per year.
And they have to tell what days they're going to be sick.
Yeah.
Ahead of time.
I'm going to get the flu in 3 months.
Yeah. I'm going to get it on a Thursday because I can't get it on a Monday.
I'm only going to be sick for a day.
Yeah. So in a stunning upset, the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen, BELT, sounds like bacon, lettuce, and tomato, the 28,000 member union of railroad workers has elected a new president, Eddie Hall. And he's a local officer out of Division 28 in Tucson. and he won against the incumbent, Dennis Pierce, with 53% of the membership vote.
All right.
And he takes office this month, January, and will lead the larger of the two unions that make up the Teamsters Rail Conference. And the surprise victory is the latest fallout from a national freight rail showdown, in which some 60,000 railroad workers had a contract imposed on them, which we explain. The issue, money's always nice, but how about some sick leave?
Hmm.
Because we're human
than,
beings.
More than one person on a crew for a train.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, safety issues. Oh, yeah. Safety issues. And they were forced to accept that by their previous leader, Dennis Pierce, who may have had his hand in the pocket of management. And they just booted his butt.
Yep, for good reason.
Yeah, and so there's some justice. I'm really glad to see that it's one of three unions that came within hours of striking in September. The Biden White House got involved and leaned on everybody, and Secretary of Labor Marty Walsh. And in June, they took a strike vote, and members returned ballots, voted 99.5% in favor of striking to get their needs met.
Mm-hmm.
And their former union leader sold them down the river.
And
he bowed to pressure. Oh, it's the best I can do. That's what they always say.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they always say.
We have to treat our bosses like they're people and not part of an institution. Mm-hmm. That inherently robs us of the full value of our labor and also forces us to work in unsafe working conditions without proper or adequate sick leave.
Well, here's something he actually said.
Yeah.
Here's a quote. Pierce, the former union boss. Contracts between the railroads and their employees have never had sick time. He said in a separate interview, there are lots of industries that don't have that in their contract.
That's why people go on strike.
Yeah.
That's not an excuse. We've never had sick leave. That's something that you inherently should be fighting for. You represent workers.
Well, you know what? This jerk, it cost him his job.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye, Pierce.
And that's no small thing, because if you're a large AFL-CIO affiliate union, mm-hmm. and you are the elected president, you get a substantial salary, and you get in on the executive benefits of the AFL-CIO itself.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're making five figures as a union representative, well, you need to pack that in and join the IWW. We'll give you sandwiches and stuff, and we'll help you, you know, typing things up, but we ain't going to give you no five-figure salary. And that keeps us honest.
And that is also, there's actually a fantastic series of articles from the Industrial Worker, which is our national online publication for the IWW, that does a whole breakdown on why we, the IWW, don't have paid union staff the way that the AFL-CIO does. I don't think there really is hardly any paid staff in the IWW, because we recognize that there's a conflict of interest there. I could never do it justice, even with the 90 minutes we have on this radio show. But again, and I just want to stress this, this is also the reason why we as members of the IWW stress the power of the rank and file. The AFL-CIO does, in writing and in word, stress that as well. But when it comes to situations like this, where we have quote-unquote, you know, managers of labor, higher-up ranking officers of these unions essentially caving into business and political interests or pressure, that is counterintuitive and counterproductive to the rights and dignity of working people organized in unions. And it's good that this Pierce guy got voted out, and it's good that we have a thorough process of democracy in our union to make sure that if somebody steps out of line or if somebody does not adequately represent the will of the workers, there's the door. We'll still let you in the club, but you're not going to hold this position anymore.
But for right now, aside from the IWW, I just want to say, way to go, railroad engineers. You got guts. You stood up. You would not take it laying down.
Absolutely. There's also been some political fallout as a result of the failure of the railway strike to manifest, both also on a political level. We had 4 out of 5 members that were endorsed by the Democratic Socialists of America who ultimately backed the settlement that the government was trying to impose on the railway workers. And while I do have some criticisms of the Democratic Socialists of America on a political basis, I think that even their reaction to this has been really appropriate. On a national level and on a local level, there have been several statements by the DSA basically saying, we do not endorse the actions that our politicians that we have endorsed have made. Mm-hmm. We are going to be rescinding any official endorsement of these candidates, and we're going to have a better review process as well as a better accountability process for who we endorse in local and national elections. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's important because... And this has been a long-running trend in politics that, again, an hour and a half could never do justice. But there are plenty of people in politics who call themselves pro-labor, who gain the support and donations and endorsement of unions, specifically from the AFL-CIO, that then go on and do contradictory stuff when they're in office.
You mean stab us in the back. Get our vote and stab us in the back.
Bingo. And, you know, the IWW does not endorse political parties or candidates for this reason, even if they are explicitly pro-labor, because we recognize that our fight as workers trying to organize our workplaces is on the shop floor and not on the floors of Congress. And while the floors of Congress can be important in terms of how our legal rights as workers are defended, ultimately it is our power as a mass of workers that will force them to do what we want them to do. That is our vision for the future. And I think that there do need to be serious political inquiries and consequences for these so-called pro-labor politicians and candidates and parties when things like this happen.
Like even Biden.
Because...
needs to be held accountable.
Yes. That's there is an election next year. It is going to be the possible re-election of our current president, the possible re-election of a bunch of these people who call themselves pro-labor, and this needs to be one of the points that gets brought up. Anybody who supported the suppression of this rail strike, who screwed over these 60,000-plus railroad workers, and the industries that work around it as well, need to face some accountability. And I know since the election season is coming up, our ability to heckle at them is probably going to be decreased because we're going to have a bunch of people in our ear saying we need to back these people or else, you know, these conservative Christo-fascists are going to make it to office. But just because somebody is a lesser evil does not mean that it is not your duty as a working person to hold them accountable. And we need to start holding these people accountable. If they're not pro-labor in action, unions should not be endorsing them. End of sentence. Rant over.
Good one, though.
Thank you. As always with our labor news sections, we will also be providing updates on these stories as they go forward, because these have been the two largest labor stories that have been taking place on a national level over the past several months. We will give you more updates in the February episode as to the Supreme Court case, and if there is any more political or union-related fallout as a result of the Railway Workers United settlement, we will keep you in touch. And now for our roundtable discussion, considering that Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday is on Monday, and today is Saturday the 14th, we wanted to talk a little bit about his work and the intersection of civil rights and labor rights. Shortly before he was assassinated in Memphis, and this is coming from the King Institute at Stanford, the night before his assassination in April 1968, Martin Luther King told a group of striking sanitation workers in Memphis, Tennessee, "We've got to give ourselves to this struggle until the end. Nothing would be more tragic than to stop at this point in Memphis. We've got to see it through." King believed that the struggle in Memphis exposed the need for economic equality and social justice that he hoped his Poor People campaign would highlight nationally. On the 1st of February 1968, two Memphis garbage collectors, Echo Cole and Robert Walker, were crushed to death by a malfunctioning truck. 11 days later, frustrated by the city's response to the latest event in a long pattern of neglect and abuse of its black employees, 13,000 black men from the Memphis Department of Public Works went on strike. Sanitation workers, led by garbage collector turned union organizer T.O. Jones, and supported by the president of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, AFSCME, Jerry Wirth, demanded recognition of their union, better safety standards, and a decent wage. The union, which had been granted a charter by AFSCME in 1964, had attempted a strike in 66, but failed in large part because workers were unable to arouse the support of Memphis's religious community or middle class. Conditions for black sanitation workers worsened when Henry Loeb became mayor in 1968. Loeb refused to take dilapidated trucks out of service, or pay overtime when men were forced to work late night shifts. Sanitation workers earned wages so low that many were on welfare and hundreds relied on food stamps to feed their families. So just off of this section of the article, I think it really speaks to the testament of Martin Luther King Jr. and his Poor People's Campaign and how he saw economic inequality and the issues that were specifically facing these sanitation workers as part of a broader movement to help correct economic injustice, especially as it relates to Black working class people. And I think that that is something about his work that often doesn't get mentioned in a lot of textbook discussions about him. You know, at a basic educational level, we like to focus on, you know, the March on DC. We like to talk about the
Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SCLC.
And SNCC.
Right, and SNCC as well. He was a part of these organizations that were really trying to form a coalition of people that fought against not only racial injustice, which is a very, very important core issue facing a lot of working class Americans, but also economic injustice as well. He was often labeled as being some kind of red agitator, especially during some of his early work, by not only local members, reactionary members of various communities, but also by the federal government as well. The FBI kept a notorious file on him and had attempted to harass him out of his work several times. But I think that
they tried to set him up too.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. At one point they wrote a letter, a fake letter, trying to get him to take his own life and try to accuse him of having extramarital affairs.
Which he did do. They told his wife.
Mm-hmm. And they tried as hard as they could to try and stop his movement because they saw it as potentially a threat to business interests, to the government, to possibly creating some kind of revolutionary movement out of his work, which ultimately he did. I mean, you know, the 1965 Civil Rights Act and various other repeals of legal racial segregation, especially in the South, were repealed because of his work. He was quite the revolutionary. I think that he really did focus on an intersection of the anti-war movement, an anti-capitalist mindset in regards to how workers are exploited, especially marginalized workers, as well as anti-racism, all into one big movement. And I think that it's good that we reflect on that.
Yep. The word intersectionality had not yet been invented.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what he did, is he united different areas of social justice work. And for that, we are thankful, and we also keep in mind that Martin Luther King Jr. would want us to stop and recognize that nobody does the work by themselves.
Absolutely.
It takes a community, a village, a union, all unions.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let it be noted that one of Martin Luther King's early supporters and a pivotal member of the civil rights movement was also a leader of a large and powerful labor union. We're talking about A. Philip Randolph.
Oh, yeah.
He was president of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters and made Black industrial workers part of the American labor movement, whether the American labor movement was ready for him or not.
Thank you.
And there was a lot of very virulent racism in the labor movement. But there was a tremendous amount of white supremacy in the labor movement, and A. Philip Randolph influenced Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. about that, saying, you know, showing him that, because that once they got recognized as a union, the other railway unions naturally marched in support of them. In varying degrees, like we talked about,
mm-hmm.
But definitely further to the left than the zeitgeist, you know, the feelings of the times. And A. Philip Randolph was a labor leader and a hero for civil rights too, and he influenced, I think, Martin Luther King to stand up for these sanitation workers as a civil rights worker, but standing side by side in solidarity with the labor union.
Absolutely.
So I think it was pivotal in the whole civil rights movement.
And I think to touch on something you said earlier, there has been a very long history of racial discrimination in unions. This mm-hmm. goes all the way back to the Knights of Labor, even around the time immediately following the Civil War and the Reconstruction era. a lot of unions at the time were typically in quote-unquote professional trades. They had their own training programs and education programs for their workers, but they were almost predominantly white. Mm-hmm. There were white unions.
And male.
And there were black unions.
Don't
and they
forget.
Were predominantly men as well.
Yeah.
So that kind of segregation has existed for a long time. Here in the IWW, since our founding in 1905, we have always stressed that, you know, not only are we a union of all workers, but all workers means all workers. And we have had a culture, not a perfect culture, but definitely a culture that positively addresses racial injustice in organized labor, making sure that workers of color and their concerns in the workplace are heard, making them as involved in organizing campaigns and education campaigns as possible. We were one of the earlier unions to stress the fact that discrimination is not welcome in our union halls and in our organization,
right,
and that it needs to be addressed whenever it comes up. And like you also said, fellow worker Gordon, I think that that was really a turning point for a lot of white majority unions to say, actually, no, labor rights are civil rights. Civil rights are labor rights. And when we fail black workers, we create a disparity that allows employers to manipulate
right.
us against our fellow workers mm-hmm. rather than against the capitalists and the
mm-hmm.
bosses.
And typically, black workers especially, and workers who were recent immigrants to the country from Southern and Eastern Europe, were used as strike breakers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you can just picture, you know, some boss coming up and say, hey, you guys want to earn a dollar a day? Everybody just say, yeah, and signing on to break a strike, going, which creates friction, because you know if you see a whole line of black workers coming in with picks and shovels, that they're taking your job literally.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so outreach was imperative. And it's best illustrated in a fictionalized version of that in the film Matewan. If you get to see Matewan, see that, because it shows a memorable scene with James Earl Jones in it, and how a former Wobbly, we don't find out why he's a former Wobbly, but he had organized with the IWW, and he lectures these good old boy miners union people as to, if you don't see this man as a fellow worker, then you're just in a club, you're not in a union.
I think that it's important that we reflect on not only Martin Luther King Jr.'s work, but also how that work continues in the present day in the labor movement. There have been...
And in the civil rights movement, and in the environmental justice movement.
Yeah.
All of these continue.
Right. And like you said perfectly, Marilyn, there is a... Even though that term wasn't invented yet, he really did a lot of the... Him and his organizations that he worked with.
The intersectionality.
Right. They laid down the groundwork for what we know as intersectionality today in the labor movement. I'm kind of starting to run out of thoughts here. Does anyone have anything else they want to add?
You're talking about racial inclusion in the IWW, and to bring us up to date on that, the IWW in its various rebirths has lately come to be known as kind of a white kids union.
Should be a second.
Yeah. Talking about racial diversity in the union and labor movement in general, we have to talk about racial diversity in the IWW. We started out with those good intentions, and we maintained them until, of course, the union was suppressed and almost collapsed in the early 1920s. But we did have entire black locals on the waterfront in Philadelphia and in other industries around the country. And they had to have it that way because of the racial segregation laws. But they were IWWs, 100%. And they ran their general membership branches and industrial branches by the letter, right? So what I'm getting at is that today, if you come to an IWW meeting, you may not see a whole bunch of faces of black people or people of color, depending on your location, because we kind of got a reputation of being a white kids union. But we're not. We never started out that way, and we are very much interested in outreach to workers who feel oppressed any place in the country. So just to reiterate our intention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that is an important conversation to have, especially, I mean, not just in labor unions, but also in progressive and leftist spaces, that in a lot of places, it's still very much white majority. And I think that there is an unintentional but still very present white ignorance in these spaces as well, and that we do need to stress being not just racially conscious, but anti-racist as well. We need to make sure that the voices of fellow workers of color are just as loud as ours, if not louder, in instances or discussions like this. We have several programs in the IWW that do amplify those voices and make sure that they're heard, to make sure that fellow workers of color have access to the resources and funds that they need, as well as transportation funds to our National Congress every year as well. We really do the work that we can, but again, it always starts from a place of recognizing that ignorance and then actually providing space and amplifying the volume of fellow workers of color.
Greetings, fellow workers. My name is fellow worker Gordon, and I'm going to be giving you a little bit of an update about labor-related issues and other social issues that happen across the Narrows Bridge in that wonderful wilderness known as Kitsap County and Bremerton. So this month's show, I'm going to just verbatim read an article published, written by fellow worker Sean, of our outfit out there in Bremerton. Not yet a branch, but we're working on it. And he wrote this and had it published in the Seattle Worker newspaper, which is an excellent publication of the Seattle General Membership Branch. They budget for it. It comes right out of their monthly dues. They don't charge workers a nickel for a copy. And it's a pretty slick publication. So if you can get a copy, you can talk to Seattle Worker online, or write to them if you have a paper copy in your hand, and you can get a paper copy or an online copy. So to get on with reading Sean's article, he begins, "Over the weekend of October 21st, Bremerton IWWs attended an anti-racist getaway hosted by the People's Institute Northwest in Tukwila. The three-day program focused on cultural competence to educate organizers on fully utilizing our organizing potential through diversity. What this meant was that I got to spend a transformative weekend in Tukwila listening to BIPOC folks agitate about racism. It was lovely, and it changed me. I recently caught up with one of the organizers I met at the training, and we're both looking forward to the next training because we both have now come to realize the healing that can occur when we gather in groups to talk about racist trauma. We want to do that more together. I recommend the PINW anti-racist training because it's an opportunity to build solidarity with minorities, which is the best way to combat racism. I enjoyed sitting and listening to African Americans share their pain, and they had a lot to share. The training has a lot in common with the IWW because it embraces fellow workers as free-thinking agents, uniquely shaped by their experiences in the status quo, which aligns with the IWW's practices of creating a culture of care, education, and listening. Take the training if you want to build some solidarity with people from different cultures. I also learned about a different approach to solidarity with BIPOC fellow workers, cultural competence. The central idea of the cultural competence training is that culture is shaped by a multi-generational response to the basic human need to survive and thrive on a planet with limited and varying material conditions, and that political movements are best when they are diverse. A lot of our discussions focused on cultural competence, which is the just notion that we should respect and embrace different cultures to build our movements. As an aside, fellow worker Sean comes from Dutch Harbor, Alaska, and he's registered as a tribal member, a Native Alaskan, and he gave the land recognition announcement at the beginning of our punk concert out there in Bremerton, which was pretty cool. He says, "I'm Native American. I'm going to give you the I'm going to give you the land acknowledgement," and he did, and the people liked it.
And that concert was a fundraiser.
Yes, absolutely. It was a fundraiser for Food Not Bombs, and we were proud to be involved in it. And just to say that Tacoma Branch donated a large amount of clothing. Shout out to fellow workers Mac. And food and time to help these people set up. So it was very successful. It got the word of the IWW out. All right. Well, he goes on. I'm not going to read verbatim because I'm going to run long. But here's an important sentence. He said, "I chatted with a fellow worker in the Black Prisoner Caucus who mentioned feeling inferior at school and being held back for poor grades because his way of knowing and learning was different from the European one being imposed on him. And this could, and I'll break again as an aside, this can apply to Native Americans. It can apply to kids who are feel gender dysphoria or nonconformity. It can apply to religious and racial minorities. Think of all the Muslim kids in America now who are just being raised up in their family's faith and who face terrible abuse at school and racial epithets. You know, we got to open our hearts up a lot to that. Fellow worker Sean goes on. He says, a weekend retreat with the PINW helped him, talking about this black prisoner, understand his emotions in the context of a racist system so that he could heal and find community. The slogan often repeated was, I am because we are. Hmm. And I'm going to end that there. He mentions some historical parallels with the IWW Lawrence, Massachusetts strike, which goes way back to 1916, I think, and how that strike was successful because they addressed the workers in their own languages. 16 languages were spoken at those factories in Lawrence, Massachusetts. They created textiles and fabrics, and they had workers from Eastern Europe, and they had workers from all over the world who didn't speak the same language, and that's a surefire way to keep workers separated. The IWW solved that by publishing newsletters and posters and silent organizers in all 16 of those languages.
That's fascinating.
Wow.
So that's a good historical thing.
Yeah.
It's a practice we should revive. And I especially want to get IWW involved in more other than English language
materials. Absolutely.
Well, thank you for providing that article. I know fellow worker Sean has been doing a lot of active organizing and work up there on behalf of the IWW. I really like that he talked about the prisoner experience and the ex-convict experience as well with this individual. Because the IWW, we do have an Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee.
Yes, we do.
The acronym is IWOC.
IWOC, thank you. And we do see it as important for organizing workers, even those who are behind bars, because they are another class of employee that is often exploited by the private prison industrial complex.
If the listener wants to get involved, we meet on the third Friday of the month at Manifesto Coffee at 3:00. And you are welcome to come and check us out.
Absolutely. We would love to hear from people who have been convicted or part of the prison system at some point, or people who have been historically at risk of becoming a part of that population.
You want to support people who are currently in prison.
Yeah. There's letter writing campaigns. Yeah. There's campaigns to get, learning materials inside. And, just general support for the people who get incarcerated.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Thank you so much for providing that Kitsap Labor Notes report.
Sure.
Hopefully we'll hear from you and fellow worker Sean Moore in the future, and we look forward to your incipient little branch beginning to build out there. So
incipient little branch. We're going to take over this whole outfit over
Good.
There.
Take the whole place.
We're going to take the whole thing and broadcast.
It may be incipient, but it's not insipid.
There we go. Yes, fellow worker Lynn?
I want to cut this out. But, so if a person writes letters to incarcerated people, we wouldn't have their names or anything. How would we actually
do
that?
Have
sometimes
names.
You have their names.
Really?
Sometimes
have,
there's
a... They volunteered to have
yes.
their names out there.
We
okay.
did some research.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And some, cool. sometimes these guys just want a pen pal.
Sure.
Guys and gals.
Sure.
Yeah. And it is good that we have that letter writing campaign, because not only can it provide moral support for those who are behind bars, but it can also keep them educated on what's happening outside of those bars as well.
They can keep us educated too.
There you go.
Because I know there's an upcoming strike.
Yes, there is.
They're working on that. So
thank you so much for that report, fellow worker.
I have just gotten the little gesture that it's time for me to start. This is Marilyn, and I'm going to do a little environmental unionism update. As you know, we have been considering the railroad workers' plight an issue with environmental unionism, because if they don't have a healthy environment to work in, then that is definitely an environment. But I'm going to start this section off with a list of successes, because it's easy to get dragged down. And I get a little magazine because I support them from Earth Justice. And I'm just going to do a few little updates here of what they've been able to accomplish, and by they, I mean we. That means all workers. So in California, the headline, and this is the latest issue of Earth Justice, their quarterly magazine. This is winter 2022. In California, a federal judge vacated a Bureau of Land Management decision that would have allowed Cadiz Incorporated, a water supply company, to drain a large Mojave Desert aquifer. This decision, which dates to the last days of the Trump administration, violated federal laws by failing to consider the project's potential harm to federal public lands or to analyze its impact on a historic and environmentally sensitive piece of land. So, conservation groups challenged it, and it went to court, and they won. In Alaska, conservation groups challenged a controversial drilling program. Once again, Bureau of Land Management, which is pretty much in the pocket of big business, approved the Peregrine Exploratory Drilling Program in Alaska's Western Arctic. But BLM's approval didn't consider the greenhouse gas consequences of burning the tremendous amounts of oil that the Australian developer 88 Energy hoped to produce. So Earth Justice is fighting the program's approval in federal court on behalf of the Sierra Club, Friends of the Earth, Greenpeace USA, and all who want to see a transition to clean energy. Nationally, the judge reinstated a ban on coal leasing of federal lands. Tribal and conservation groups represented by Earth Justice won a federal court decision halting the leasing of federal lands for exploitation by coal companies, reinstating an Obama administration ban. Here's our friend again, Bureau of Land Management. The court directed the Bureau of Land Management to review the practice which leases public lands at a pittance to boost industry profit at the direct expense of the environmental and global climate. Earth Justice is calling on the Biden administration to go further and phase out existing coal leases entirely. God, I hope that happens. So those are three little victories. In spite of DeJoy being still the head of the USPS, they have announced they're partially electrifying all their vehicles. So that's good. So I'm starting on a positive note. However, here's a discussion topic, and I'm welcoming people to get involved in this around the table. Mm-hmm. This is from the IWW Environmental Unionist Caucus. And this is an article from AOL.com and written by Maggie Angst. Good name, Angst. A-N-G-S-T. January 3rd. Name of the article is, As California Pursues Aggressive Climate Goals, What Happens to Its Oil and Gas Workers? And I'm going to read you a little bit of this, and we can just chat about it. It's, as California transitions away from fossil fuels in the years ahead to pursue, I'm a little short of breath, to pursue aggressive climate goals, an increasing number of oil and gas workers across the state will be forced to put their skills to use elsewhere. Well, duh. That's been used aggressively to combat any kind of environmental progress. But just how many workers will be affected and how difficult will it be for them to acquire new jobs earning comparable salaries? And I like this article because it actually breaks it down. A new analysis released Tuesday offers a rosier forecast than previous predictions. The report, produced by the nonpartisan think tank Gender Equity Policy Institute, counted about 59,000 workers directly employed by the oil and gas industries in California, and of those workers, the analysis found that 2 out of 3 will likely be able to move directly into new jobs in other industries without any retraining.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. So when people tell you that if they don't pursue this oil and gas folly, that, oh my goodness, the poor workers will suffer. Okay, then it goes on to say, for workers at serious risk of displacement and whose skills are not as easily transferable, the report estimates that the projected cost assumed by the state of California to support them with income subsidies and relocation assistance may also be far lower than prior projections. Mm-hmm. Our data absolutely shows that there are people who work in the oil and gas industry who will be negatively impacted by the transition to clean energy. But the big takeaway from our study is that an equitable transition is both affordable and achievable, said Nancy Cohen, president of the Gender Equity Policy Institute.
Radio Tacoma, 101.9 FM, KTAH, LP, Tacoma.
So I did want to open that up for a little conversation because there's been a lot of talk around this. What do you all think about that?
Well, I think that it is important as we transition more towards green energy and as some of these types of job fields that work in traditional energy production, such as coal and oil, begin to die off. I think that it is important that there are unions, or there are at least programs to allow unionized workers to go into other industries, preferably green energy industries, to receive that kind of cross-training without a loss of wages or benefits. I think that that is an extremely important part of the conversation that covers a pretty wide variety of industries, actually, that are dependent on fossil fuels in order to keep working. This isn't talking about just the agriculture, not just the energy industry, but also agriculture, transportation, and so on. Yes, fellow worker Lynn?
Ideally, there'd be programs where their re-education would be paid for, or largely paid for.
Absolutely.
So that everyone who wants can participate and improve the overall situation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Once again, you're going to get pushback from the usual suspects who defend corporate capitalism in its most rapacious forms by saying it'll be, you know, cost prohibitive to train these workers. You know, but of course they're looking at very short-term analysis. They're looking at their quarterly bottom line, and they can't think far enough ahead. Institutionally, can't think far enough ahead by the nature of the economic system. That if we forego, 20% of our profits for 5 years, we can have this whole workforce retrained, right, and still make money. That's the key there. You know that. Oh, they would make money, even being heavily taxed, but they're not making enough money, which is the maximum amount they can squeeze out of every worker and every situation. So, and unfortunately, due to the nature of the economic system, there are a few major labor unions that will vote against environmental laws such as banning on pipeline. Or any other kind of construction, even an LNG plant, because they'll say our workers will be fired, directly put out of work. But the point remains is that the education of what IWW environmental unionists have always said is there ain't no jobs on a dead planet.
Right.
And so if you're going to keep shooting yourself in both feet in the long term because you're too cheap to come up with re-education for your workforce, then you will reap the consequences. That's the thing about capitalists. They don't think they're going to be held accountable. They're going to get on their helicopters and or fly to Mars or whatever. And they really believe that. They really believe they're immune from any kind of accountability. We have a job to re-educate them, to tell them that sounds a little ominous, but in the real sense of the word, to tell them, first of all, ain't no jobs on a dead planet. Ain't no jobs on a planet at war. Except making more tools for war. So, in my view, all of these issues can be linked together on the shop floor and in our social gatherings, I would hope, anyway.
Yeah, good points. Fellow worker Marilyn, if you wouldn't mind, could you give us a brief description of environmental unionism for us, just to clarify for the listener?
Okay. There are two aspects to consider when you think about environmental unionism. There is the fact that we are living in a time of rapid climate change that does not look like it's going to be good for not only human life, but life on the planet. And those of us that are concerned that there may be nothing left for our grandchildren or for future generations have been working for years to try to turn that ship around. because the large corporations, the polluting and extracting corporations, the international corporations, especially the petrochemical corporations, mm-hmm. have been what we call using extractive economies to take the raw, the trees, the clean water, the minerals under the ground, everything that is worth a buck, and take it and claim it, get it as cheaply as possible. Boy, if you can do it through a global, what is the word I'm looking for?
Globalization of the economy.
Yeah, that'll work.
Neoconservatism.
Yeah, that'll work. Mercantilism. I mean, all of that.
Right.
That use the resources that people need to live, the air, the water,
mm-hmm.
and marketize it and sell it for their own personal profit to the detriment of the environment that we live in. And it speeds up climate change. It degrades areas where people who don't have a lot of means live, because that's where they usually put most of their dirty factories.
Mm-hmm.
So it touches on minority and racial equity issues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the simple way to look at it is, even a bird doesn't foul its own nest. These corporations don't live in the communities that they foul.
Mm-hmm.
They can just dump their crap there and walk away.
And they do.
Yeah, and they do. So that's one form of environmental unionism.
Okay.
The other form is the working conditions, the environment where workers are employed. So we talked a little bit about the railroad workers. Just last week, another worker was killed in the railroads.
Goodness.
I believe it was in Arkansas. I may have the wrong state. But rest in power, fellow worker. When you provide no time for rest and renewal, that's an environmental issue, and it's a safety issue, and it's a human rights issue. That is one aspect of environmental unionism.
Mm-hmm.
When they cite extremely polluting companies in areas of lower economic opportunity because they think they can get away with it, that's an issue where the people who are forced to live there are exploited. That's environmental unionism issues. Right now in Tacoma and Thurston County, they're trying to push through an airport. Neither county, neither Thurston nor Pierce, most of the people do not want it because of the air pollution, because of the noise, because of the increased traffic on the road. Those are all environmental issues. We are all fellow workers.
Mm-hmm.
That's environmental unionism. So does that explain your question?
That was very aptly said. I think you did a great description of it. You know,
okay. I ran on too long.
No,
you're fine. I think that's a good explanation for our workers, because it is important that people know that there is an intersection between...
There you go.
Once
again,
issues.
Intersectionality.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You see, our society, ever since the rise of the Western white man, mm-hmm. and science, has loved to use linear thinking because it's handy in lab. But the trouble with it is it separates people and it separates issues,
yep.
and it's artificial.
Yep. It is. And it's artificial for a purpose.
Oh, yeah.
And when you say extractivist, right, you can conjure up two different pictures. You can conjure up, steam shovel industry, mm-hmm. digging stuff out of the ground, mining, striking right. for oil.
Or extracting workers.
There you have it. That's what I was going to parry mm-hmm. with. You're extracting profits. Okay, so there's two ways of extracting. There's raw materials, and then what you do with those raw materials to transform them into commodities or services, and how much determines the value of it is how much surplus value it has. So in other words, the workers make the products and they don't get the surplus value that comes from selling and marketing them. So that's two ways of extracting. Thanks for bringing that up. And also, I liked your definition, if you will, to think of both the lived-in environment, the planet, our, you know, the air, the trees, the mountains, everything like that, but also our work environment. Mm-hmm. I like the way that you emphasize that because, you know, we can create our own environment of work if we have the knowledge and the tools to understand what we're working for. Mm-hmm. You know, why are we producing all these widgets? What's the widget market doing like? And to figure out where they all go, how many are needed, that the workers should be deciding that. Because if we don't need iPhone 29, we don't need, you know, all these, you know, modern inventions.
Yeah. We don't need planned obsolescence.
That's right. And that's essential in capitalism. Hitting that point. Things have to break. You know, I wish my truck was a Rolls Royce because it would probably last for 50 years. But no, it's a Ford, and so I gotta repair it every so often, and it's getting to be more and more major.
My coffee maker died last week, and I love coffee.
Oh, my God.
But I loved that coffee maker because it lasted for years and years and years.
It was a fluke.
And I was going to be damned if I was going to buy a different brand. So I went around, and most of the big box stores only carry two brands of any one thing. Did you know that?
Yeah, I've seen it.
Yeah. So I went to various different stores and none of them had it. So I wasn't going to give up. I finally found it. So you didn't even notice that was a new coffee maker because it looks exactly like the old one. But that one lasted years and years and years.
Well, let's hope this one follows in its footsteps.
That's absolutely right. Mazel tov. Mazel tov. Have you all heard of Extinction Rebellion? Of course.
Yes.
You have.
Of course we have.
And it's international. So I was reading some very interesting article. No, actually, it was a chat on 350.org, and it was about Extinction Rebellion. And I just wanted to present this idea for discussion if we have time. Yeah. If not, we'll bring it up another time.
We can discuss. We still have about 15 minutes.
Extinction Rebellion UK has decided that it's no longer going to engage in really disruptive civil disobedience, that they feel like they have great enough support and recognition in the UK to start pursuing a different path. And Extinction Rebellion NYC, New York City, while they were supportive of UK's position, said that's not, sadly, the position that we're going to take, because we don't have the same support and recognition nationwide or citywide. And we need to continue education through massive disruption in order to become visible on the public's radar.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to throw that open for what people think about that.
Well, with respect, Extinction Rebellion has made its name by being disruptive.
Yeah.
And necessarily so, in my opinion, even though I might not participate in all their actions and their style, I understand the need to be disruptive. If our fellow workers over there in the UK have determined that the political situation is ripe for them to, you know, focus on more legislative things, let them go for it. And equal shout out to, what was it, XR New York?
Yeah.
You know, who have a different set of contradictions and conditions. So they feel, okay, good luck. You know, good luck with that. But we're still going to do die-ins and we're still going to, do mass demonstrations. So
I think the risk is when you think you've got that level of recognition mm-hmm. that you no longer have to be disruptive or confrontive, that it may be that you're at risk of getting co-opted.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Definitely. Absolutely. This has certainly been an issue in the environmental act and in a lot of different forms of activism, whether that's racial justice, justice for women or for sexual and gender minorities, stuff like that. That liberal co-option of those movements has definitely been kind of an ever-persistent threat, especially with this new wave of climate activism. However, there is a note I would like to touch on, and it starts like this. Is anybody familiar with a book called How to Blow Up a Pipeline?
No,
tell us. It's a book written by a man named Andreas Malm, and he really talks about how nonviolence in the structural sense of the environmental movements like Extinction Rebellion. While those kinds of protests and producing agitprop to get people motivated to talk and hopefully act about environmental issues in whatever ways they can, that's great. You know, obviously I have my criticisms of the English branch of Extinction Rebellion because of that particular decision.
But go ahead.
He goes on to kind of talk about that this kind of nonviolent activism of, say, spraying orange paint on a car dealership or having die-ins and stuff, that's good. It draws people attention, but it doesn't usually end up resulting in actually attacking the root of the problem, whether that's capitalism as a whole, whether that's the local coal refinery. He basically makes the argument that activism and education is one thing, but actually acting against the production of fossil fuels or the burning of fossil fuels is another thing. And his whole book, How to Blow Up a Pipeline, is talking about how things like industrial sabotage or climate-related sabotage on these sites should be a necessary form of climate activism. In this particular case, between England and New York City, I think New York City is making the better argument of we need to continue to have demonstrations and pull attention and get people educated. Mm-hmm. But Malm makes the point that, like, you do have to go a step further than that. And that's what I think a lot of people in the environmental justice movement are looking forward to next. Currently in Germany, there is an 80,000 person coal plant sit-in that the police are actively trying to break
right now.
80,000?
Yeah. 80,000 people are currently having a sit-in.
You know, I actually did a Zoom meeting with people in Germany last year, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really interesting. They've come a long way since then.
Mr. Malm is basically saying that these environmental justice movements, such as Extinction Rebellion, they're going in the right direction, but you have to take the next step. What the people are currently doing in Germany at these coal plants, whether that's mining or coal energy production by having these sit-ins and directly disrupting that industry, is the next necessary step. And again, I'd like to emphasize, I think what Extinction Rebellion New York is saying is the correct thing. However, education and protest is not enough. Things have to escalate at some point because the problem itself, the death of the climate and the death of vulnerable species needed to keep the Earth alive, that's still happening.
If I can pipe up, I think it's a good example of the theory about many methods, many paths, same goal. So people like Extinction Rebellion, fellow worker Marilyn, you've heard me trash talk about paper mache puppets and, you know, and people in turtle suits and how I don't think that's real serious. Mm-hmm. But I've changed my position over the years because it is only one front. It gets a crowd's attention.
Mm-hmm.
And people say, what are these crazy people doing?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe,
and if it looks like fun, people may be attracted to it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or if it looks outrageous.
Yeah.
If it looks outrageous, you know, like, whoa, and you'll get this weird admiration. Boy, I don't have the courage to dress up in a turtle suit and do that and throw paint on a Van Gogh. I can't do that. But I'm glad somebody is.
Yeah.
And then there's the people who are slogging away down in the basement of City Hall, revising rules and revising permitting processes. There are legislative efforts afoot.
Exactly.
And so there are many different paths. Union organizers, civil rights organizers, even church groups.
You know what my shorthand is for all of that?
Go ahead, tell me.
It's a breath mint and a lax.
That's good.
That's horrible. I like breath mint.
Anyhow, that's it for my report, essentially.
Thank you so much, fellow worker Marilyn. Closing out the show today, we'd like to talk about some local events upcoming.
Oh boy, would I. Thursday, January 19th, the Tenants' Rights Action Conference. They are meeting from 6:30 to 8:30 doing conference planning. Can hold your nose and go on Zoom. You can get an invite to attend that conference meeting, which is working toward Tenants' Right Action Conference, which will be happening February 11th from 12 to 4:30 at Evergreen, Tacoma, on 6th Avenue. So we have January 19th, there's a planning session. It's Zoom, 6:30 to 8:30. Tenants' Right Action Conference, which will be happening at Evergreen, February 11th, 12 to 4:30. January 22nd, take action against white supremacy and Islamophobia. That will be a YouTube that will be live streaming, and you can find that YouTube at Valley and Mountain. It's called Valley and Mountain, and it's from 11:30 to 3, January 22nd. The name of the presentation is Take Action Against White Supremacy and Islamophobia.
A couple other events that are coming up. There is the movie The Wobblies. It was a 1979 documentary. There's going to be a free movie screening at the Silverdale Library. Mm-hmm. That's 3650 Northwest Anderson Hill Road at the Rainier Room. That's on January 28th, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Another event that's also coming up, and this is coming out of the Whatcom Skagit branch of the IWW all the way by the Canadian border, Learn the Basics of Workplace Organizing, IWW Organizing Training 101. That's coming up in Bellingham, Washington, February 4th to 5th, all day, both days, and it's going to be in person. Yes, fellow worker Gordon?
And if this doesn't get out in time, you know, for the listening audience, you can always look at IWW websites in general and in branch sites in particular for this IWW Organizing Training 101, which we call OT 101, like the college course. And it is an extremely useful course for people just thinking about what it takes to get your fellow workers at any kind of shop, any kind of shop floor environment organized, how to form an organizing committee to get better representation, how to do this without getting fired, how to take also other direct actions. But what I'm getting at is if you don't hear this announcement, please check the IWW website to find out around the union where these various OT 101s are happening. Seattle's going to be having one. Seattle's going to be sponsoring the convention this year, which happens in September. So it's down the road. But please try to pay attention to announcements if you want to attend. If you're in the Pacific Northwest, they opted for in-person only. So if you go, there may be health restrictions like mask requirements, and just be aware of that because the pandemic ain't over. Although I'd like it to be, but it isn't. So if they're asking you to wear a mask or, you know, things about children, bringing children or what to eat, just contact the Seattle branch of the IWW. And for the OT 101 and any other ones coming up, contact the Whatcom Skagit branch up in Bellingham. And just keep your ears open for other opportunities for training.
Well said, fellow worker. Any further announcements, fellow worker Marilyn?
I want to go back. So I want to make an announcement regarding 350 Tacoma, which is an environmental unionism group. They are located at 311 Puyallup Avenue. They will be having their monthly potluck, and we should have this up and on the air in time for that. Their potluck is this coming Wednesday, January 18th, and it's at 6 o'clock. And so they'll have their potluck. You can meet and greet. You can find out what they're about. And if you care about our planet, you can jump in and help out.
Thank you so much. That looks like that's about the conclusion of our show here. So thank you so much for joining us on the WOB Radio Show. We certainly hope that you join us at 3 p.m. and 11 p.m. on Wednesdays and Saturdays. And we look forward to continuing to provide news, information, and education about labor rights, labor history, and ongoing organizing. Thank you so much for joining us in solidarity.
Is behind us, we shall not be moved, just like a tree that's standing by the water. We shall not be moved. We shall not be moved, just like a tree. Together, we shall not be moved. We will stand and fight together. We shall not be moved, just like a tree that's standing by the water. black and white together.
We shall not be moved just like a tree that's standing by the wall.